Welcome, Chief of Police Robert Tracy, and it's a pleasure to see you again.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for having me again.
Great to see you. Let me get you quickly on some national stories before we obviously talk about Wilmington. And that is, in Memphis, we've seen a terrible collision between people in the community and the police, and this followed the use of federal agents, federal marshals, to in effect an arrest an individual wanted, I guess, for a shooting in Mississippi. It does bring to mind, it was the Memphis cops that bore the brunt of this, but it was federal marshals who initiated this thing. How much coordination is there if a federal or other jurisdiction comes in? Do you even know about it?
Yeah, absolutely. And Alan, in my years, when I was back in the NYPD, I ran NYPD U.S. Marshal Hide a Fugitive Task Force and had almost 40 officers, federal, state, local authorities. And in a city the size of Memphis, I believe that there has to be, this is a regional task force, and there should be state and local partners that are aligned with the feds in those units. I don't know all the details. And because it is a U.S. Marshal Task Force, I can only see what's on the paper, what I read from the paper. But there is a lot of coordination that goes on, especially when you come into each jurisdiction to make sure we deconflict, to make sure that we know someone's coming in, we're looking for fugitives. And apparently, from the news media reports, this person was wanted from a shooting in Mississippi. And then, therefore, reading about the accounts that came out afterwards, he was armed with a weapon and trying to ram his vehicle into the officers trying to make an apprehension. So the details will be flushed out, and we really have to trust the system. We have to trust the system that's in place, the internal affairs, the Attorney General's office, to take a good look. And I think they have a state inquiry that comes in of law enforcement officers that come in from the outside to take a look at this case.
Well, again, I ask that because, you know, it's one thing. One of your officers was involved in an incident, and then all of a sudden other officers have to deal with it. But you can imagine psychologically if Memphis cops almost kind of felt this was brought on us.
Yeah, it's tough. Anytime that you have this type of conflict with the community, and I think communication is the key. And what we always have to teach ourselves and look at best practices is make sure that those formal and informal leaders of the community, we get that information out as quick as possible to fill that vacuum. Because a lot of misinformation starts to get out there. And when that gets out there, you start to see the results that happened in Memphis. And I'm not saying everything wasn't done right there. But the quicker you can get that information out, those relationships you have with those leaders in the community. And, you know, as we go in this interview, I always talk about community engagement and the importance of community engagement and trust. And sometimes that can offset some of the things that happened in Memphis.
Yes, sir. Okay, another national story I wanted to get your informed commentary on. Body cams, of course, the general conventional wisdom is police body cams are good for everybody involved. You have some evidence of what actually transpired during an incident. But in California, Sacramento, California lawmakers are considering barring officers from running facial recognition programs on body cameras. And well, obviously it's not facial recognition of the officer. We know who the officer is, but rather of the people around the officer. That's kind of a civil liberties question, and I'm not sure a lot of people ever thought about that before.
Right. And sometimes when people are asking for things, it's has to be well thought out, has to be carefully thought out, and where you want to go with these body-worn cameras. Because I think some of the people that have been insisting on body-worn cameras are the same people now are insisting on, hey, there's privacy rights that they want to make sure they're not violated, or certainly there's protections, and it kind of works against each other. So there's a conflict now, what's happening, and you know, facial recognition has been used by a lot of police departments. And it's used more specifically when you're looking for a person that might be ID committing a crime, and you don't know who the person is, and then you can look that up to identify the person to bring them to justice.
And I think fewer people are going to complain about the civil liberties issues with that than just kind of random facial recognition of a whole crowd around an officer, maybe.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we look at body-worn cameras, you know, in this day and age, there isn't a place that you walk through or go by every so many feet that you're not on camera, on some type of camera. Whether it be at traffic lights, buildings, coming into places, even doorbells. So body-worn cameras are not the only thing that are observing things. There's so many other types of video that are out there that we're dealing with in this day and age.
it does bring to mind something else, I think, even from the time when you were a young man, just considering a law enforcement career. I mean, just imagine the explosion of surveillance of all types. In many respects, it's got to make the policing job easier.
It definitely makes our job. We leverage this type of technology and new technology. If you embrace it and leverage it, we can actually help reduce crime with some of the technologies out there that wasn't available when I came on the police department in 1984 in the Bronx.
Of course, the contrarian view, some civil libertarians, you know, Big Brother looking all over, what's the difference between that and China? I suppose even some law enforcement people, while acknowledging all the benefits, might struggle once in a while with the all-pervasive surveillance.
Right, and you know, there's protections in place, even coming down to search warrants and arrest warrants. A lot of this goes before a judge. You have to state your case why you need these type of things. And we make sure that we follow the law constitutionally and fairly. And that's what we teach our officers. So we work within the rule of law and what we can do with these videos or social media or search warrants. So there are protections out there to make sure that, first, we should be training them to do it right. And we'll make sure we get the permission, the proper permission to use this technology.
You think the proliferation of surveillance has made the legal issues more daunting for officers, or it's pretty much understandable?
There's challenges out there and what we can and what we can't use. Does it make it more daunting? I believe the advent of type of cameras and everything that we have out there right now, if you train your officers well, I'm not worried about them being on camera. It's how you behave when you're not on camera is the character and integrity of a police officer. So if you train them right and you make sure that you're hiring the officers that have the type of personality and the integrity to make sure that they carry out the awesome job and responsibilities we have, those are the things that I'm looking for. If I need cameras on my officers to make sure they're doing the right thing, then I've hired the wrong officer.
Understood. A difference between that and just saying that cameras are good, but the idea that the only time they're going to mind their P's and Q's is when they know they're being monitored in some way.
And cameras have really helped officers out when sometimes there's been accusations and everything. Once you look at the videotape, it's cleared a lot of officers of any accusations of wrongdoing.
Oh, yeah, it works both ways. Yes, okay, well, the 99th Police Academy still proceeding?
Yes, it is. And it's it was great because we had a ceremony for the Special Olympics right in front of the Wilmington Police Station where they carry the torch. And then the Special Olympic Games continue down at University of Delaware. And it's great to see our 30 Academy recruits are out there running for charity. They're out there. They began on March 4th, and our academy runs for 23 weeks. In mid-August, we'll have them graduated, and we'll have them on the streets, which will bring us back up to our budgeted strength, which any police chief wants to make sure more officers I have works better with our strategies and is better for the public.
So where are you now on manpower, and where would you be?
It would bring us right up to our 315 officers at budgeted strength when these officers graduate the academy. And listen, right now they're being trained in Delaware state law, forensic investigations, operating patrol vehicles. I saw them out there the other day, firearms training, police legitimacy and procedural justice, respect to the community. And as always, you hear me say this, community engagement, taught how to make sure we treat the community with respect, because it doesn't make a difference how great a strategies we have in place. If we're not doing it with the community and treating the community with respect and working with them, we won't be able to sustain these things, and right. We're getting better and better, and that's why you're seeing the results that we have after 2 years.
But you said 315 for the cap?
315 is our budgeted strength. Yeah. These 30 officers, when they graduate, will bring us back up to our budgeted strength.
Now, let me ask you, sir, okay, got the 315, sounds like a big number, but when you count in different shifts, vacations, illness, other incidentals, how does it come down in terms of human power, manpower per shift?
Well, and that's what you hit the nail on the head, Alan. The things that happen with, we call them regular days off, illnesses, administrative suspensions, and other things that we have to make sure that we can't put them on the street. And I call it, what are the boots on the ground? How many people can I use operationally that I can put out to reduce crime? And, we're probably down about 20 officers that I'm unable to put on the street between long-term sick, line of duty, administrative reasons, and military. We have quite a few military.
Oh, yeah.
People that are serving both the police department, and then they're deployed long-term and short-term. As if you wanted to just take raw numbers in any police department, I really don't want to give up how many people are on our shifts, but if you look at a police department as a whole, just think two-thirds of the department's working, one-third's off at the time.
At any given time.
At any given time, and then split that number in half because we have two shifts for a 24-hour period.
Do you have more working at night than during the day, or not necessarily?
We have. We've been able to stagger our shifts. We will have two main shifts, but then we stagger times and roll call times to make sure that we have more officers on the street at the peak time for calls for service, and then where intelligence-led policing has led us, where there are conditions that are happening that we need to address with additional officers. So we have the flexibility within our tours and through the collective bargaining agreement, I have managerial rights where I can flex these officers to the times that I need them at the most critical times.
How does it work at transition times, or do you try to even it out so there isn't a sudden depletion during a transitional shift?
Well, that's exactly what we look at. You know, there's so much analysis that goes into this. And then there's adjustments. Time of year, sometimes we adjust when, you know, daylight savings, when it gets darker, when school's out, when, you know, in the summertime, when do we start seeing the trends? We look back last year. It's all an analysis to make sure that we're pre-planning and we're not reactive, we're proactive to what we need to do to keep people safe.
I have to confess, this sounds kind of mind-boggling, juggling all this.
It's actually quite thrilling for me because I love this sort of chess game to make sure that we're in the right place at the right time and teaching these officers how to be very strategic and not just being reactive. And it's not just boots on the ground and putting a person in a place, but it's looking at these conditions, when they're going to happen, time of day, day of week, and who's committing these type of crimes that we're identifying the people. So we don't have to arrest everyone to make a difference. You know, the old way we used to do policing is just put everyone out in that area, arrest everybody in the community, hoping to get those very few that are committing the most violent crimes. Why not identify the ones that are committing the violent crimes? Everybody knows who they are. Look at them first to see if we can get them help. But if they want to cause carnage in the community, look to make sure that we make the proper arrests and make that community safer.
You've already hinted at it, but talk about now the special demands and, I suppose, opportunities of the summer in terms of foot patrols and police community interaction and all the rest.
Yeah, it's definitely a holistic approach. You know, you talk, what are we going to do different in the summer? If you're doing everything that you're supposed to be doing, the plan should work all seasons. And one of the things that we insist, even in the wintertime, when I talk about intelligence-led policing, where do we need our officers at such times? There are certain times that we have breaks between calls for service. And if you keep the same officer in the same area every time that they work, they get to know the community, they get to begin to go to every community meeting, and the community gets to know them and they build trust. In between calls for service, my officers, where the community's asked them to be and where I've asked them to be through intelligence-led policing, they're getting out of the cars, they're putting their hats on, and they're walking foot posts to make sure that they can engage in the community, not sitting in a car with the windows rolled up and the air conditioning on. So it certainly has made a difference, and the community has seen it and has been so much positive feedback. Secondly, when you come to the summertime, there's a whole holistic approach that's not just about policing. It's about this administration and what the mayor's doing and his strategy and making sure that we have several hundred high school students, that we have jobs for them. We have internships that the mayor's making sure that he's pushing through. We have things with Parks Department as far as the PAL and all these recreational things that we can do for the youth when they're out of school. There's just so many things. We have play streets that we're closing down all summer long, several nights a week in different areas, different council districts, that we make sure that we have places for people can be, they can be safe. And we're doing that in conjunction with the Parks Department and also with Christiana Healthcare.
From your vantage point, then, the more activities and things going on for young people, all the better for you and the community.
And one more thing is for the summertime that we always begin. Starting Monday, we start the WPD Youth Academy. So these are 13 to 17-year-olds get to see everything that we're doing in policing. Hopefully, we can instill in some type of way that they get to know us better, and maybe these are our future police officers.
How are they recruited?
An application process goes out. We put it out through social media and put it out through the schools, and then they all apply. And then usually we get about 30 kids that actually want to be in the program.
Since you talk about potential future police officers and recruiting, I'm wondering for you, given all the obvious trauma that police departments around the country have experienced in interactions that go badly, and all that. I mean, you hear people call talk shows say, why would anyone in the world want to be a police officer today? How challenging is that, that someone coming up is maybe has the law enforcement spirit and mentality, but does fear that he or she, you know, could suddenly be accused of something or another? I know the body cams help, but just that it's a deterrent today, whereas somebody starting out in the 60s or 70s might not have that mindset.
Right. Certainly, I think there's a silent majority out there. I think some of the detractors against policing or police officers, that's a minority with a loud voice. When you see communities, when you go to community meetings, the amount of support that we receive, it's out there, and the officers love it. When we recruit police officers, we want to make sure they have that certain mindset. That's why we have a 23-week academy, and then we put them through another year training on probation to make sure they're really cut out is exactly what they want to do, so they're not locked into this profession. But I think it's a certain mindset. And then what I'm seeing today, we're competing against a lot of other industries because the unemployment rate's really
so low.
Really low compared to where we were in the past. People were coming on because they needed a job. Now we're getting more people because they want to be police officers and because they have so many other choices.
So you're getting that despite the fears I could be sued, the community could revolt against me.
I think right now the best recruiters for any police department, probably any industry, well, the people that are in it, family, friends, and neighbors, and that actually talk about the profession that they're in. And where we're going in the Wilmington Police Department, I think the pride, the morale is up. They love what they're doing. They're seeing things that are happening. We're making better gains with the community and the community support. So I think that friends, family, and neighbors are talking about the Wilmington Police Department. So we had 175 applicants this last go-around, where other police departments around the country and even in the state, having trouble recruiting officers. And,
well, yeah, News Journal had a piece about the smaller communities in Delaware, and you have to really kind of feel sorry for them. Fewer resources, less pay benefits. Mm-hmm. Inevitably, some want to move up to Wilmington PD or county or state.
Right.
But it's daunting, I guess, if you're a police chief in a smaller town.
Yes, it absolutely is. And I read that same article, and plus I'm part of the Delaware Chief of Police Council, and you know, I talk to my counterparts and colleagues what they're going through, and we continue to find ways that we can introduce policing to youth academies and really get out and market ourselves that this is a good profession. It's a rewarding profession, and you know, and like I said, nationally we might be taking some hits as far as what we do, and there's some detractors out there, but the majority of people, even in the most challenged community, really appreciate the police and appreciate us.
Just like firefighters or military, how much are you still seeing that it's a family thing?
Oh, it definitely is. It definitely is a fraternity or sorority now, because we do have a lot of female police officers, and their ranks are growing, which is great. And we're getting the diversity that we need as well. But
I also mean just where a family has a tradition, every generation comes up with a police officer.
There is a police officer, you know, not all become doctors and lawyers, but there's some police officers, and it definitely my family is representative of that as well.
Well, I was mindful of that, yes. All right, well, Chief Tracy with us here in studio, Delaware. We'll be back